As nurses, the stress of harming our patients weighs heavily upon us. Anyone who has made a med error or had a patient fall knows that the path to healing is fraught with potential pitfalls. In today's episode of Up My Nursing Game, we are going to hear about a fascinating case study shared by Dave DeVell, the author of the book Brand New Nurse. The case has many teaching points, such as treating patients with incomplete medical histories, altered levels of consciousness, the daunting task of managing agitation with limited resources, as well as a deep dive into anaphylactic shock. By the end of this episode, you will be better prepared to step in when harm has been done to your patient because you will have a better sense of how to manage anaphylaxis from early detection to rapid treatment and what to anticipate in recovery. You will also have some extra tricks up your sleeve for caring for patients with unknown histories and managing cognitive impairment. Let's dive in. Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school.
My name is Dave DeVell. I'm a registered nurse. I work in New Jersey. I'm on a progressive care unit, so we get a really wide variety of patients, everything from neuro patients, post-stroke, we'll get some cardiology, everything all the way up to high-risk postpartum and things like that. In addition to my time at the bedside, I have written a book, became an author, and I also host a blog to help new nurses that are entering the profession.
What made you decide to write a book?
I've always known that I wanted to write a book, but it took 30 years to figure out what I wanted to write about. And I was working at the hospital. We were right in the thick of COVID, and I was a pretty new nurse myself. And I was precepting new nurses coming onto our floor, and they were struggling with the mechanical actions of nursing, you know, checking blood pressures and dispensing medications, things like that. And I talked to this one orientee and I said, you know, did you practice these skills in clinical? And she said, well, during COVID, there were no clinicals. These nurses were coming into the profession. They had never touched a human patient before, and they were getting a paycheck and they had a license to protect. And, you know, all the stress that comes along with being a new nurse anyway was compounded tenfold. So I got some good feedback from some of the newer nurses that, you know, I was giving good advice. So instead of just helping the one or two nurses at a time as I precept them, maybe I can help more nurses. So writing my book was the best way I could think to disseminate that information to as many people as possible.
When we spoke previously, you told me this fascinating story about a patient that you had in your PCU. And I'll let you describe the case study from the beginning. But when you told me about this woman who was very complex, I thought there were so many wonderful teaching points to it, both clinical and kind of higher level skills to, you know, assessment and communication. I'm really excited for you to share this story with the listeners today. Yeah, I'll let you take it from here.
Yeah, it was a very interesting case. So this patient came into our hospital a couple months ago. She was a 61-year-old female patient. She came to us from a skilled nursing, assisted living type place, initially presented to the emergency room because she had been given another patient's daily medication regimen. And so she came in as a polypharm overdose. From the report I got from the ER, paramedics arrived. Actually, EMTs arrived initially. The 911 call went out because the patient was just lethargic. So when the EMTs arrived, they immediately realized that, you know, something didn't look right with the patient, and they were worried about her level of consciousness and potentially losing an airway. When they assessed her, they heard wheezing. they did see a rash on the patient's face, her neck, down to the front of her chest. And so they immediately called for paramedics. I know some states are different, but in New Jersey, we'll typically have EMTs dispatched in their basic life support. And the county will run ALS and paramedics, so they'll get dispatched separately. So paramedics on scene looked her over. It looked like an anaphylactic reaction to some of the medications that she'd been given. So they administered epinephrine. They put the patient on some albuterol nebulizers, and they initiated rapid transport then to our emergency room. So when the patient did get to our ER, the ER nurse told me in handoff that she was very, very lethargic. They were debating whether they were going to intubate her at the time. Her anaphylaxis did not appear to be stable, so they gave her more epinephrine. They gave her Solumedrol. She was given IV Benadryl and more nebulizers. And they did see some reversal from all of that, so which was good. So they were able to avoid intubation in the ER. They were able to stabilize her.
I'm going to jump in here and do a deeper dive into anaphylaxis. So anaphylaxis is a severe and potentially life-threatening allergic reaction that occurs rapidly after an exposure to an allergen. In this case, the allergen was a medication, but other agents can include food, bee stings, or venom. And what's happening here is that the allergen binds to antibodies on mast cells and basophils that then dump inflammatory mediators, most notably histamine, into the blood. Now, what do we know about histamine? It's a potent vasodilator and bronchoconstrictor. Two very scary things, right? Like, honestly, I'm so mystified about why our bodies would have this reaction to drop blood pressure and tighten our airways, because it's not really compatible with life, right? Why would our bodies voluntarily do this to itself? I looked this up while I was researching this episode, and while it's not totally understood, we think that anaphylaxis had an evolutionary advantage because it helped us to expel parasites by increasing vascular permeability. Another advantage that's proposed is that inflammation promotes wound healing. And when it comes to bronchoconstriction, it's thought that by narrowing the airway, the body is limiting the entry of harmful toxins. Also, bronchoconstriction can cause forceful coughing, which could help us to expel the toxin. Whatever the reason, the fact remains that blood vessels will dilate and airways may constrict. Okay, so how does this all present in our patients? Going organ system by organ system here, starting with skin, changes to the integumentary system are going to be the most common symptom of anaphylaxis, occurring in about 90% of patients. So changes here are going to be, you know, what you expect from an allergic reaction: erythema, flushing, pruritus, itching, urticaria, raised welts, angioedema. This is the swelling of the deep layers of the skin that will be really evident on the face. You can, you know, kind of imagine your patient's eyes swelling shut or their lips puffing up. But it can also involve the hands, feet, genitalia, and the larynx, which is the big bad one we're going to get to in a little bit. GI involvement happens in about 45% of patients, and this is going to present as nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and abdominal cramps. Cardiovascular involvement is going to be hypotension, tachycardia, syncope, and pulmonary involvement will be upper airway obstruction. So this is going to be stridor, this is going to be swollen tongue, swollen uvula, voice changes, bronchospasms, and shortness of breath and cough. It's important to note that the progression of anaphylaxis is fast. So get this, the average time from allergen exposure to reaction is 5 minutes for iatrogenic reactions. So this will be like your IV anesthetics, IV contrast, IV antibiotics. 15 minutes for venom and 30 minutes for food. Generally speaking, the faster the onset, the poorer the prognosis. In my experience, one of the sickest patients I have ever cared for had an anaphylactic reaction to IV contrast. And remember, the time between exposure of an IV medication to reaction is about 5 minutes. That's it, 5 minutes. So it was really a miracle that that patient survived given the tiny window of time that the staff were able to recognize and then treat his anaphylaxis. Now, he received contrast because he was getting a CT chest done for a workup related to acute coronary syndrome. So unfortunately, the anaphylaxis was thrown on top of an already damaged heart. And ultimately, days later, he did not survive. So what does treatment look like? In a single word, it's epinephrine. As soon as someone has ABC involvement, that is an airway obstruction, breathing difficulty, or hypotension, it's time to grab your IM epi. If a patient has involvement of any two systems, like diarrhea and angioedema, it's time to grab your epi. Now, before I did research for this episode, I thought that all patients would get the kitchen sink of epinephrine, antihistamines, steroids, bronchodilators. But the more I read, the more I realized that it's really the epi that does it all, while all other medications are just supportive at best. Let me explain. In anaphylactic shock, we want to open the airway. Epi does that. We want to treat hypotension. Epi does that. We want to rapidly stabilize the mast cells from releasing more histamine. Epi does that. While Benadryl is sometimes ordered, it will only really help with patient comfort by reducing itching. And sometimes steroids are ordered, especially in the cases of severe anaphylaxis. There's actually no good evidence to support its use. If you want to take anything away from this episode about anaphylaxis, it's that epinephrine is the life-saving drug and should not be delayed. Okay, under the section of treatment, I also want to mention that intubation may also be indicated for airway protection. And this needs to be done as soon as possible because, as you can imagine, it is very hard to pass a tube through a very swollen airway. So going back to epinephrine, what does epi administration look like? Most of the time, IM epi is going to do the job. It will start working within 5 to 15 minutes of injection, with effects lasting 20 to 30 minutes. As you can imagine, the patient may need additional doses of epi if symptoms start to return after that 20 to 30 minute window. Now, if a patient is in an area where there are providers who are well-versed with epinephrine, your patient may get an order for an epi drip. IV epi has a super fast onset and allows for much tighter control of the patient's hemodynamics. Now, what happens after that initial resuscitation, whether it be in the ED or 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 during a rapid response? If the patient is intubated and or on an epi drip, they will surely go to the ICU. All cases of anaphylactic shock will remain in the hospital for observation for at least 8 hours to monitor for the rare instance of biphasic reactions. All right, that's it for anaphylaxis. Let's go back to Dave's patient.
We had limited medical history on the patient. It was really just what the caregivers at the facility were able to relay off to EMS. And we were still waiting to get paperwork from the facility.
So you didn't know which medications she took?
Not initially, not until pretty much the moment that she was being transported up to the PCU. Fortunately, it looked like at that point the anaphylaxis had subsided, but we were still fighting the patient's lethargy. Now, this patient is Down syndrome. So that was the first curveball because it's going to be difficult for us now without knowing the patient's history to establish a baseline. you know, so we're performing neurological exams and things like that. And we were told that she is somewhat verbal at baseline, but we don't know what that means. We don't know if she, you know, is typically oriented times four, you know, is she very high functioning? Is she not? You know, so we were up against a couple challenges here. You know, one, the polypharm and not really knowing what we should treat. So, you know, we're looking at chemistry labs and things like that, and you know, her liver enzymes and stuff, and just trying to very conservatively balance out her lab work. We did finally get a list of the medications that she received, and we were reading the list and we were just shaking our heads because she got Keppra. She got multiple psych medications that she was not prescribed. She got Latuda. She got a bunch of stuff. I'm trying to remember the rest, but it was a long list. She took a handful of pills that she was not supposed to have. And so, you know, and all at once. So we weren't able to pinpoint exactly what caused her anaphylactic reaction. When we got her list of home medications, there wasn't much on it. I think she had like a baby dose of Coreg for hypertension, and I think Synthroid. That was maybe it. So she had a stable respiratory pattern when she arrived at PCU. She was still wheezing a little bit, so we continued with nebulizers. It was a dicey ER admission to get. We didn't know at what point she was going to really round the corner and start improving. Enough time had passed that I don't think that it was appropriate for us to place an NG tube and try to actually, you know, get any of that stuff back out of her. I think everything had pretty much at that point been absorbed. So we put her on a bicarb drip. We just started treating the chemistry. You know, her potassium was really low, so we did replacement. I think we ended up giving her some magnesium riders too. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that we were very closely monitoring her. You know, as her mentation started to improve a little bit, that's where I really wish that I could reach out to somebody at the facility, but we were having communication problems back and forth. I really just wanted to know what my patient's baseline mentation was. I needed to know if what we were doing was working. As she started coming back around, and then she, you know, her mentation improved, then her energy levels went up a little bit, and she was following commands. She was able to identify herself. She could not give me an accurate birthday or anything like that.
But you don't know if that's baseline.
Right, exactly. I don't know if that's normal for her or not. I was just glad that she was able to track. I mean, she made eye contact and she tracked. And, you know, that just in and of itself over the couple hours, you know, in between arrival on my unit, when she came to a little bit more, that was a drastic improvement. So then, you know, you have in nursing, sometimes you have this paradox where you want your patients to get better, but then as they get better, they get a little squirmy and anxious and they want to get up out of bed all the time. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we started. Yeah. So that's why he said, we want you to get better. But yeah, it was nice when you weren't trying to leap out of the bed every 10 mm-hmm. minutes. Mm-hmm. And so that started happening. In addition to the other home medications I mentioned, she took Eliquis at home for a history of AFib. And I remember that now because we didn't know the last time that she got a round of Eliquis. So we put her on a heparin drip, and that became a big risk factor for her in her very lethargic and, you know, not able to adhere to our fall precautions state that she was in. She kept trying to get out of bed with a heparin drip running. And I said, you know, if this lady hits the deck, you know, she's really going to hurt herself. And we're going to have a hard time assessing that, you know, because of her altered mental. So it was a challenge. So then we kicked into, you know, we already went through all of these stages of pathology and trying to figure out, you know, when we got the list of medications, what are we going to do to, you know, sort of remedy this polypharm overdose? We're doing very frequent neuro exams, very frequent airway exams. And now we're compounding it even further because now we have this issue where I have a 61-year-old Down syndrome patient. I have to find a safe and compassionate way to keep her in the bed. So we tried having doing Q15 type checks, and we would have somebody round on her every 15 minutes. The big thing was she wanted to get up and go to the bathroom. We had one of the external urinary catheters set up on her, but you know, she wasn't paying any attention to that. She wanted to get up. her trying to get up was becoming more frequent than the every 15 minute rounding. We have telly sitters, a little camera. I call them RoboCop, but it's a camera that kind of sits in the room. And
yes.
I know. I'm sure they probably hear the people monitoring, but I'm sure they hear me all the time too. I say, knock it off or RoboCop's going to yell at you.
Yeah.
So we tried that. But our policy is that if the telemonitor, if they come on and they try to redirect the patient three times in a set amount of time and they get ignored by the patient three times, they fail the telesit. So she failed the telesitter. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be kind of rough, you know, as it usually is, pulling somebody for a one-to-one sit. So the logical next step for us would have been restraints. But I really try to do my best to avoid restraints, especially in situations where I think that they could do more harm than good. And, you know, with a patient like this who, you know, we don't know her baseline, but at the time she's not neurologically intact, as far as we can tell. We don't know if she has a history of traumas. She doesn't know, you know, what her life has looked like, but she has, you know, her baseline is cognitive impairment. And so she's probably not going to be able to understand the way that a lot of people would understand if we had to use these restraints, you know, to keep her safe and in the bed. So we came up with a game plan. We said, let's try a roll belt because it seems to be the least restrictive and the least potentially traumatizing, the least uncomfortable, but at least we know that we can keep her in the bed safely. So when we went in and we went to apply the roll belt, she was speaking in 3 to 4 word phrases at this point, and she sort of had like a childlike affect. And so we rolled with that, and myself and another nurse, we, you know, as we put it on, we said, hey, listen, you know how you put your seatbelt on every time you get in the car to go someplace? She said, yes. I said, all right, well, this is the seatbelt for your hospital bed. So anytime you're in the hospital bed and we're not in the room, you have to wear your seatbelt. And she said, okay. So the other nurse and I looked at each other and we said, okay. So we're real, you know, gentle about it. And we explained everything. We said, okay, we got to put this strap through this strap and this is going to go behind your back. And, you know, we talked her through it. She was very cooperative, agreeable and everything. We made it a rule for ourselves because we told her, we said, you know, it has to be on when we're not in the room. So if we went in the room, even if it was just to pass a medication or to do another reassessment, first thing we did when we walked in the room is, all right, well, we're here. Let's take your seatbelt off. So we would undo it from both sides of the bed. And we say, hey, is it okay if we just kind of leave it around you right now? Is that all right? And she'd go, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So we would do what we had to do. As we're getting ready to leave, we'd say, oh, seatbelt back on. And we would secure it back to the bed. It worked. It worked. It kept her safe. She wasn't unhappy about it. At one point, she was really unhappy yelling in the hallway, but that's because she forgot about the catheter that we already had in place, and she really felt like she had to go to the bathroom. She was afraid she was going to wet the bed, and now she's got her seatbelt on. She's saying, you know, I need my seatbelt off. I have to get to the bathroom. And we ran in there and helped her, but that was the only issue that we had, you know, after we applied it. So
that's so sweet.
Yeah, it worked great. And we, because we knew, you know, we knew. I said, if I have to go in there and put like soft wrist on this lady, there will be a special place in hell for me. Because like, I just don't want to restrain somebody in that kind of a circumstance. The doctors were on board with the restraint order. They said, just whatever you need, let us know. You know, but that was one of those areas. We were living in the gray. I mean, you know, I had the provider's blessing to, you know, to soft wrist, you know, tie this lady to the bed.
What were your constraints for a sitter, a one-to-one?
At that time, it was staff. We appointed her a one-to-one sitter. We would lose one of our PCTs on the floor, and that can be rough. We're a 24-bed PCU, and we generally only run 2 PCTs. So with all the complete cares and things like that we have, if we go 1 PCT for 24 patients, it's usually a rough day for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, this could be a whole nother podcast episode in and of itself, but, you know, part of me wonders, like, well, in the situation where she would not have responded well to having a, you know, quote, seatbelt on her, what can the hospital do in those circumstances to produce the resources to get a one-to-one sitter. Something that I've talked to with, you know, other guests on this podcast is that sitters pay for themselves. I think if you're looking for long-term ROI in the hospital, it would be for a sitter instead of sedating and restraining. In this case, it would just be restraining. But in my experience, like 90% of the time, restraints make things worse.
They can aggravate people for sure. And in a perfect world, you know, where we look at hospital budgets and they have a realistic mindset like you do, you know, talking about ROI on things, you could also justify having that, you know, army of PCTs and CNAs to prevent everything from pressure injuries to falls. Fact of the matter is, for most hospitals, they're two different buckets of money. And so when they, at the highest levels, when they look at how they budget, you know, they don't make the connection for some reason.
I was wondering if you wanted to share any takeaways for the story you shared about the 61-year-old woman with Down syndrome and the polypharmacy overdose.
The biggest takeaways for me, takeaway number one, don't give a patient an entire handful of someone else's medications. Try not to do that, because had that not happened, we wouldn't have this case study and all of the things that have come with it. Takeaway number two, when you have a patient that has had recent anaphylaxis, you need to anticipate what could happen if an emergency were to arise. And you need to make sure, do I have access, immediate access to the medications that I would need to rescue that patient? Will my facility let me pull the epi and keep it on me? You know, like the old trick for low heart rate that you tape atropine to the bedpost. You know, am I allowed to have that available, you know, to carry an EpiPen during my shift to make sure that I have it ready to go for this patient?
Or to have a PRN order for it ready to go.
And that was the first thing that I checked. I said, hey, this patient's coming up to me. Let's make sure that all the orders are in place so that I should have no problem running and pulling the meds if I need them. So from a clinical point of view, just ensuring the orders are in place and making sure that you're on top of your assessments. You know, that is a patient that you should be rounding on very, very frequently. Let your buddy know if you have a buddy on the floor, you know, whatever neighboring nurses are right there and have patients around that one. Everybody should be aware of what that patient is in for and things to look for. That could be a big difference. You know, maybe that nurse goes in to respond to a call light or something and they pick up on that. It's a heck of a head start to get things fixed. So, and then the other takeaway is that human side of things, you know, not just because the doctor, you know, you say, hey doc, you know, she keeps getting out of bed, and they say, oh, no problem, I'll write for restraints. All right, well, let's be cognizant of the fact that we're treating this whole human, right? And we do have a responsibility to look at the big picture. If I take somebody cognitively impaired and tie them to the bed, what are the ramifications of that? Well, sure, I know she's not going to fall, but is she going to live the rest of her life with some sort of a trauma from having strangers come in and hold her down and tie her to a bed? So you have to keep that wide angle lens and just kind of look at the big picture. There are ways to say, without being overly aggressive, but, you know, to say, have we considered, you know, have we considered another, is there an alternative? Have we considered that that might be traumatic for the patient?
I love that. I like all of those phrases that you're using here. You know, I'm concerned about, have we thought about? I think there are very powerful ways of introducing your opinion in a way that will have a higher likelihood of being well receptive. Dave, this has been awesome. I'm so happy that you wrote this book, Brand New Nurse. Where can listeners find you?
The book is on Amazon. Just look up Brand New Nurse on Amazon. It's available as a paperback or an ebook. And if you want to find me and connect with me, you can find all my socials are at The New RN. And my website is thenewrn.com.
Dave, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was great. I really enjoyed talking with you.
If you've made it this far into the episode, I can only assume you found value in our discussion. I'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to leave a 5-star rating or review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Podcasts don't
don't really go viral, so it's really word of mouth that keeps shows like this going. Your ratings and reviews go a long way to make sure that I can continue to provide high-quality content for you. Until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.